If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on Christ's side. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They live on milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. And they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You run down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life by fighting in the fog of that key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let the song I'm singing be a warning. And you run down my country, man. You walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. You know, the insane attack on free speech just continues apace from many of the social media, but in this case, from Facebook. And here I have an illustration of this article, which features a Maoist soldier, complete with the star in the green khaki hat, etc. Now, of course, this is an illustration, but I think it's really quite apt. And Facebook will soon be banning conservatives for committing hate silence. Your thoughts are not your own, says this item. And I think it's really quite serious. This is from the Tea Party. And it says here, Facebook is stepping up their censorship game. Natural News was just recently banned for content that was never even shared on the social media platform. And that's a scary occurrence. Just when we thought big tech was already the most powerful industry in America, they prove they have even more tricks up their sleeves. When Facebook is looking to create is an online echo chamber where everything posted and not posted is lockstep with the leftist agenda, including all things LGBT and, of course, abortion or baby murder. And so let's never think that the Silicon Valley crowd are really in favor of free speech. They're in favor of a managed left-wing agenda. As Ethan Huff points out in an article on Evil News, soon, if you don't brand all your profile photos with the overlayered six-color rainbow of LGBTQ, etc., during Pride Month, for instance, Facebook might decide to terminate your account for committing hate silence. Remember during the after the attack on Charlie Hebdo in Paris 4 or 5 years ago, a lot of people would sort of overlay their own photo with the French flag and the slogan "Je suis Charlie." Well, apparently, the fear now is if you don't actively promote the Pride, and it's not Pride, the Gay Pride Month, you might be seen as an unreliable dissident and just simply chucked. And this would be called hate silence. This is the direction where things are headed as the tech cabal increasingly targets free thinkers who break from the herd with suspensions, shadow banning, deplatforming, and even permanent bans for violating their ever-evolving litany of community guidelines, which always cater to leftists at the expense of conservatives. And of course, these community guidelines are just a load of bollocks. They have nothing to do with... the community never set these standards, incidentally. They were set by the oligarchs of political correctness in Silicon Valley. So it's not really what the community decided. And of course, the community, so-called, is so, I hate the word, but this is true, so diverse. Well, what would be community standards? You know, the only acceptable standard, quite frankly, and this is what we have to demand, is let freedom reign. That's right. The only standard we want is free speech. And that provides a good, rollicking debate. Not everybody has to agree. Everybody doesn't have to be on the same page. Say, oh, yeah, I agree with that. But that's not the point. We don't all have to agree. That's the wonderful thing about freedom of speech. Wide open argument and debate, with different points of view being aired, and some people liking what they hear, and other people giving it the raspberries. That's freedom, and that's really, that must be our non-negotiable demand. I've been encouraging people to spread these ideas, and I've been actively spreading them for about the last 6 months, but we have to go on the warpath demanding legislation that will treat these behemoths, these near monopolies in Silicon Valley, as public utilities which must be compelled by law to serve everybody. And of course, I can just hear the howls of, yeah, but there might be hate there. Well, yes, there might. And it is the individual's responsibility who publishes that. So, if you publish libel, somebody can go after you. And they won't be going after you at Facebook, nor should they. Anyway, continuing with this article. Now the truth is deemed hate speech, and whether you post it or just quietly support it, you're likely to violate Facebook's ever-changing community guidelines, as they are dictated by the ever-devolving leftist agenda. Don't be surprised when conservatives are soon being targeted for committing hate silence by simply holding different views than the loving, tolerant left. Once Facebook sees that you're not publicly supporting Gay Pride Month or the mutilation of prepubescent trans children, you'll be flagged and targeted and perhaps chucked out. This kind of censorship is absolutely insane and a direct violation of our First Amendment right. It's also extremely hypocritical of the left, which is something that has become par for the course. Literally every idea, cause, or movement the left pushes is somehow in contradiction with either itself or other leftist ideas, causes, and movements. Or just look how their victimhood hierarchy is constructed. At the very pinnacle of the caste system are transgender people. Then women are somewhat toward the top, but not higher than the transgender. Now biological men are dominating women's sports simply by claiming to be a woman. The transgender agenda is at odds with women's rights and equality. Now we have the far left yelling fascist at conservatives, all while they blatantly censor us across all forms of social media. Now they want to control our thoughts and take away our right to have our opinions and beliefs. This has to stop. There's no way that they don't see how hypocritical they are, which makes it even more disturbing. As Huff puts it, this is what today's left expects, after all. Absolute compliance with every single one of their progressive dictates, no matter how insane or ridiculous. If you even so much as dare believe that abortion is murder and that dismembering unborn babies is violent and evil and should be illegal, you're deemed a threat to the left. If you post these obvious truths, they will accuse you of hate speech. And if you don't post content that shows you support baby murder, they will accuse you of hate silence. This is a scary direction we're going in. And in terms of the transgender, that's a direction we have gone in, where now people are, at least in Canada, are compelled to utter nonsense or face consequences. What I mean is, you have to, you cannot misgender a person. If that term doesn't immediately ring a bell with you, it means calling them what they are, quite obviously. If they present physically as a man, even if they think they're a woman or a platypus, you call them, well, you refer to them as he or him. If they present as a woman, even if they think they're a man, you refer to them as she or her. Ooh, but that's misgendering. You are, at least in Canada, compelled, or they would like to compel you, to play in their diluted play box, in their diluted playpen, which means that you must call them by whatever silly name they think they are today. Our only hope is that President Trump makes good on the allegations he has recently leveraged against big tech and follows through on his promises to end the censorship by the big tech tyrants. I certainly agree with that, and strongly urge Americans to contact the president and urge him to make this high on his agenda, because it is important. It's really important that that we go on the offensive and rein in the tyrants of political correctness, particularly rein in the people who are censoring a wide range of people. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com, where it's moving, coming around to that time again, and that's we're getting close. We're only a couple weeks away from August the 5th. And 2 years ago, on August the 5th, we lost a great free thinker, a man who did a great deal in challenging the new religion of Holocaust, paid a horrific price, and died in Germany on August the 5th, 2018. And this is actually an appreciation from last year, but what he says, the author says, holds every bit as true today. August the 5th marks the 2-year anniversary of Vern Sundel's passing. He was essentially kidnapped from the U.S. and forced to remain in Germany. His wife, Ingrid Rimland, was unable to leave the U.S. to be with him. She risked jail in Germany, despite having no previous convictions. Now, they actually were together from time to time, but it was never in Europe. They went to, I believe, Costa Rica, the Dominican Republic, and Mexico. But these were always really just stolen moments, or a week or two together. They were never allowed to be again as a man and wife from the time Ernst was kidnapped and sent to Canada in 2003 until he died in 2016. His crime? Ernst Sundel was deemed a security threat in Canada, not because he was ever violent or ever incited violence, but because he created a legal precedent in which, for the first time ever, so-called Holocaust survivors and Holocaust historians were closely and critically questioned under oath about their claims and views. And this was during the two false news trials in 1984 and 1988 in Canada, and this is largely because of the brilliant lawyering of the battling barrister Doug Christie, and assisted by a team of free speech supporters, including, among others, Robert Forsaw and David Irwin. Few Canadians realize that Zundel did them a favor by wiping off the books the disgraceful false news laws that were being used to strangle free speech. Ernst Zundel, 1939 to 2017, was a German-born author, publisher, and civil rights activist who emigrated to Canada at the age of 19. He became a successful graphic artist, and with his work appearing, for example, on the front page of Canada's national news magazine, Maclean's. Setting aside his thriving career, he dedicated himself to the great task, as he saw it, of redeeming the sullied reputation of his fellow Germans. For years, he was held behind bars, first in Canada and then in Germany. 2 years in Canada, in solitary confinement under appalling conditions, and then 5 years in Germany, solely for the peaceful expression of nonconformist views. For some time, he was the most prominent political prisoner in the Western world. Zundel was an outgoing, good-humored man who was blessed with a rare combination of unflagging optimism and practical ability. He was perhaps best known as the defiant defendant in the much-publicized Holocaust trials of 1985 and 1988. He was brought to court in Toronto on a charge of publishing false news, and specifically for publishing a reprint edition of a booklet entitled Did 6 Million Really Die? And Ernst did not write that booklet, incidentally. Zundel's two lengthy trials were sometimes something close to full-scale debates on the Holocaust issue. For the first time ever, Holocaust survivors and Holocaust historians were closely and critically questioned under oath about their claims and views. To wage the legal battle that was forced upon him, he brought together an impressive international team of researchers, legal specialists, scholars, and many others. From numerous libraries and archives in North America and Europe, this group assembled at the Zundel House in Toronto, one of the most extensive collections of evidence anywhere on this chapter in history. Among those who testified on Zundel's behalf in the trials were Robert Forsaw, David Irving, Mark Weber, William Lindsay, Uta Valendi, and Bradley Smith. As a result of the two trials, an enormous quantity of evidence and testimony challenging the prevailing Holocaust narrative was presented to the court and thereby was made part of the permanent public record. Perhaps the most important evidence was the historic testimony of American gas chamber expert Fred Leuchter concerning his on-site forensic examination of the alleged extermination gas chambers in Poland, particularly at Auschwitz. Zundel was found guilty in the 1985 trial, but the verdict was set aside by the Provincial Appeals Court. It ruled that the judge in that trial had, among other things, given improper instructions to the jury, and it improperly excluded defense evidence. At the conclusion of the second Zundel trial in May 1988, a jury declared him guilty. A few days later, he was sentenced to 9 months in prison. French scholar Robert Forsaw wrote at the time, "Zundel may once again go to prison for his research and beliefs or be threatened with deportation. All this is possible. Anything may happen when there is an intellectual crisis and a realignment of historical concepts of such a dimension. Revisionism is the great intellectual adventure of the end of this 20th century, that's the 20th century. Whatever happens, Ernst Zundel is already the victor." On appeal, Canada's Supreme Court threw out the 1988 conviction, declaring on August 27, 1992, that the archaic false news law under which Zundel had been tried and convicted was a violation of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. This is more than a personal vindication by Canada's highest court. Ernst Zundel secured an important victory for the rights of all Canadians. His next great legal battle was fought before the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, which operates outside of normal legal standards in Toronto. The charges instigated by Jewish groups accused Zundel of promoting hatred or contempt against Jews through the Zundel site website operated by Ingrid Rimland from the United States. In this legal action, as the tribunal's presiding commissioner declared, the truth or validity of the supposedly hateful items was not a consideration. Ultimately, the tribunal declared the Zundel site to be unlawful, but because it was based in the United States, the ruling was always unenforceable. During the 42 years he lived in Canada, 1958 to 2000, Ernst Zundel was never convicted of a crime. He was, however, repeatedly a victim of violence and hate. He survived three assassination attempts, including by arson and pipe bomb. Even Irv Rubin, the American Jewish Defense League leader, was caught breaking into Zundel's home with a member of the Jewish Armed Resistance Movement, who had previously claimed responsibility for one of the arson attacks. He also endured years of legal harassment and repeated imprisonment. After more than four decades in Canada, including a failed effort to acquire Canadian citizenship, actually three failed efforts, Zundel moved to the United States. On February 5, 2003, Ernst Zundel was arrested at home in the mountain region of eastern Tennessee. U.S. authorities seized him on the pretext that he had violated immigration regulations or had missed an interview with U.S. immigration authorities, even though he had entered the U.S. legally, was married to Ingrid Rimland, an American citizen, had no criminal record, and was acting diligently and in full accord with the law to secure status as a permanent legal resident. After being held for 2 weeks, he was deported to Canada. For 2 years, from mid-February 2003 to March 1, 2005, he was held in solitary confinement in the Toronto West Detention Center as a supposed threat to national security. His arrest and detention generated widespread media attention. A few Canadian newspapers and several independent analysts acknowledged the injustice of his incarceration. The Canada's most prestigious daily, the Globe and Mail, affirmed in an editorial, Zundel doesn't want a security certificate. Sorry, doesn't warrant a security certificate. And that was an editorial of March 6, 2004. That he posed no risk to people or property, and that he was being held unjustly on a bogus guilt by association pretext. On another occasion, I will go back over that sordid story of how, at his hearing, when he was declared a threat to national security, under legislation that was supposed to deal with terrorists, we challenged that. But you could only do that. You see, some of the evidence would be secret. Some of the witnesses would be secret. Yeah, so I mean, these proceedings were a joke in a kangaroo court. In terms of the secret evidence or the secret witnesses, the defense would only be given sort of a summary of what was said. Well, anybody with any courtroom experience knows that that's a farce. In questioning a witness, one of the things you want to know is, well, who is that person? Yeah, I mean, evidence from the village idiot, I think, can quickly be discredited. If, on the other hand, the person is a respected and prominent member of the community, that too is important. Well, all these things were denied us. In another editorial, the Zundel case, the Globe and Mail called the treatment of Ernst Zundel an abuse of the secret trial legislation. Bill Dunphy, a veteran investigative journalist and editor for the Daily Hamilton Spectator, and incidentally, Dunphy was no absolutely no friend of Ernst Zundel or nationalist movements. But anyway, this is what Dunphy did write. He spent 6 years probing Canada's so-called white supremacist movement and got to know Zundel well. Although he had no sympathy for Zundel's views, in a hard-hitting column in the Hamilton Spectator, May 14th, he told readers, "Our government has seized and branded Ernst Zundel, stripped him of his human rights, tried him in secret, and found him wanting, and now we'll hand him over to a foreign government anxious to throw him in jail." Zundel, who did this country a favor by wiping off the books our disgraceful false news laws, has never once been convicted of a criminal offense in this country, never once found to have violated the hate crimes laws that rest snugly around the throat of free expression in this country. And calculating correctly that he was no that there was no political cost, no downside to slipping on the jackboots to kick a reviled old man out of our country, our government cobbled together their best insults and innuendos and Lord knows what secret evidence and branded earns a real threat to national security. I know this man, his local and international contacts, and I know the movement. After reading the 58-page unclassified summary of the government's case, I can assure you there is no justice here. Their evidence is riddled with errors and misinformation, hearsay and inflammatory innuendo, dead men walk again, and the shattered bits of shoddy secret networks, long since collapsed under the weight of their own ineptitude, are made whole and menacing once again. It's a shameful piece of dishonest, unreliable tripe. Zwingli was held in Canada not because of his views are unpopular or because he was a security risk. He was in prison because Jewish groups wanted him there and because he promoted views that the powerful Jewish Zionist lobby considers harmful to its interests. This lobby was the decisive critical factor in the decades-old campaign to silence him. The only sustained and institutionalized effort in Canada to imprison Zwingli came from this lobby, which included the Simon Wiesenthal Center, the then Canadian Jewish Congress, the Canadian Holocaust Remembrance Association, and the League for Human Rights of B'nai B'rith, which is the Canadian counterpart of the ADL. On March 1st, 2005, Zwingli was deported to Germany just as Jewish groups had been demanding. Upon his arrival at Frankfurt Airport, he was immediately arrested and taken to Mannheim prison to await trial for the thought crime of denying the Holocaust. A few months later, the public prosecutor in Mannheim formally charged Zwingli with inciting hatred by having written or distributed texts that approve, deny, or play down genocidal actions carried out by Germany's wartime regime and which denigrate the memory of the Jewish dead. The 14 specific violations cited by the court included postings on the U.S.-based Zwingli site website. The court thus upheld efforts by German authorities to punish individuals for writings that are legal in the country where they are published. Jewish groups quickly and predictably expressed approval of the verdict. Zwingli was released from prison on March 1, 2010, 5 years after his deportation and 3 years after his conviction by a court in Mannheim. Banned from returning to either Canada or the U.S., he went to his family home in Germany's Black Forest region, where he resided until his death. Unable to leave the U.S. and be with him, his wife Ingrid died 2 months later. And that, you know, this was a very, very sad year of deaths. And undoubtedly, although he was always a very positive figure and a man in the years of persecution, I believe, shortened his life, and I think led to the death of Ingrid. Now, many people share in this sordid story. The United States bears much responsibility for the deportation of Ernst Zwingli, a country that can finds itself incapable of doing anything but literally millions of illegals, absolutely twisted the truth to get rid of Ernst Zwingli, and despite repeated appeals. And one appeal found that that basically he had been the result of injustice, of abuse of process. The irony was he could actually only capitalize on that by returning to the United States. Well, of course, he couldn't return to the United States because he was banned. So around and around they went. Ernst and Ingrid spent tens of thousands of dollars fighting this, trying to get overturn his ban from the United States. He was banned for 20 years and would probably not have been able to return until probably about 2020. Well, of course, he didn't make it to that. Much of this was obviously done at the behest of the Zionist lobby. There's absolutely no doubt about this. I saw an extremely good write-up that I wanted to share with you, and trying to find it here. I am now back on my home base, and hopefully we shall not have as many interruptions in our in our reception, or glitches and false starts. I may actually have to hold this one till. Oh yes, here we are. And this is by Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn, of course, is a revisionist writer in Texas and a very shrewd commentator. On the 70th anniversary of the failed July 20th assassination attempt on Adolf Hitler. So that would be, well, today I'm recording this in the wee small hours of the 20th of July. Traditionally, Germany's current leaders lay floral arrangements in the national colors of red and gold in the courtyard of Blenderblock, the large army headquarters in Berlin, where the plot leaders staged their attempt to take over the German government, an operation known as Operation Valkyrie in July 1944. It's still not known whether this year's 75th commemoration will be a more elaborate affair. And that was the day that the coup was attempted, and there was an attempted assassination of Adolf Hitler at his headquarters in East Prussia. But the yearly remembrance always gives the distorters of German history another opportunity to make their case for what a horrible, hateful dictatorship Germans suffered under with Adolf Hitler, and what heroes were those men who actually carried out a plan to kill their leader. And as many others of their fellow officers, and even some allies, as a bomb in a small crowded room would necessitate. It turned out to be 4 killed, 13 injured, without actually getting Adolf Hitler. To make the violent murder attempt appear more heroic, various establishment hacks make things up which are accepted without question by readers. For example, a quotation on the main Wikipedia page reads, "Little could be done against Hitler, as he was heavily guarded, and none of the plotters could get near enough to him." Attributed to an H. Kurtz. This is patently false. Hitler was not heavily guarded at all, and the top military brass had access to him without being disarmed. They all carried loaded sidearms, giving them the opportunity to shoot him on many occasions, but none ever did. The Führer reflected to Hermann Geisler afterward that they were cowards who would not face him with their dastardly act man to man, but dreamed up elaborate bomb plots which they themselves would survive and even what they hoped to escape detection. In regard to this, Geisler tells a revealing story of a day in October 1940 when he met Hitler for lunch in a small Munich restaurant he enjoyed while en route from Spain and France to Italy. After finishing his meal, the two sat talking alone at the table among the other restaurant goers. Geisler recalls Hitler pausing in the telling of his frustrations with Franco to gaze around abstractly and noticing a few patrons looking his way, acknowledging them with a smile and gesture of greeting. "I can imagine they would be surprised, to say the least, to find themselves lunching with the Führer, but no one approached or disrespected his privacy." Quite a picture. Shortly, Hitler hand-signaled his security detail, stood up, and they left the restaurant, leaving a generous tip, no doubt. Hitler was no chump in that department. There was nothing like the amount of fuss that today would accompany an American president stopping to have lunch somewhere. What motivated the plot leaders? Interestingly, The common dissatisfaction noted in the most determined and central of the plotters was on religious and moral grounds. These men took their faith more seriously than the average and saw the actions against Poland and the Jews in particular as unacceptable to them personally and to Germany as a Christian nation, in their opinion. They were not particularly representative of Germans as a whole. Their secondary objection was the harm caused to Germany's reputation in the rest of the world, and especially they wanted to work with the Allies, not against them, somehow imagining that it was possible, even after all the statements by Churchill and Roosevelt that Nazis or no Nazis, Germany had to go. It was the Germans themselves whose leaders objected to. But these men could not see that. Their opinion of themselves was so high that they were so convinced that only Hitler was the problem. Here is a rundown on just six of the most committed resistance leaders who were part of the plot to kill Hitler on July 20th, 1944. Count Klaus von Stauffenberg was of aristocratic birth, both a Graf or Count and a Schenk, that's a cupbearer, or butler of noble rank. The third of four sons of one of the oldest Catholic families in Swabia. He took up a military career and was an early supporter of the racialist and nationalist policies of the NSDAP, or the German National Socialist Party, supported the Polish campaign in the Battle of France. His brothers became involved in the Kreisau Circle, a small secret intellectual dissident group that discussed how they would reorganize the German government when the Third Reich fell, which they expected. Over time, the anti-National Socialist rhetoric from the outside world and the rumored treatment of Jews wore down Stauffenberg's enthusiasm for Hitler's policies. After suffering a serious injury while fighting in Tunisia in April 1943, in which he lost his left eye, his right hand, and two fingers from his left, he was propositioned by the conspirators, especially by Henning von Treschow. Stationed at Army headquarters in Berlin, Stauffenberg's superior was General Friedrich Olbrich, who, being in control of an independent communication system for the Reserve Army, was designing Operation Valkyrie as a plan to sweep Hitler's regime from power in the event of his death. When von Treschow was deployed to the Eastern Front, Stauffenberg gained control of the resistance in Berlin. He was now ready to go all in. Another of the conspirators was Hans von Oster. The son of an Alsatian pastor of the French Protestant Church, was the earliest opponent of Hitler among the conspirators. He joined the Abwehr, or the army, in 1933, where he met Hans Bernd Gisevius and Arthur Nib of the Gestapo, who also became conspirators and became a confidant of Abwehr head Admiral Wilhelm Canaris. He soured on the Hitler government in 1935 and came up with a plan to overthrow the Führer because of fears he would plunge Germany into war with the West over Czechoslovakia. When those fears were not realized, the plot dissipated. But Oster remained a committed foe and participant in every plot to bring down Hitler from that time onward. In 1941, his Abwehr group established connections with Henning von Treschow's Army Group Center. And in 1942, Oster recruited Friedrich Olbrich, head of the General Army Office at Bendler Block. In 1943, Oster supplied a British-made bomb for Treschow's group to place on Hitler's plane, which however failed to go off. Later that year, he was placed under house arrest for using his Abwehr connections to help Jews avoid arrests and leave the country. When Canaris's revealing diaries were discovered in April 1945, Oster was hanged along with him in the wake of the July 20th plot. Helmut Stief was born in West Prussia, was commissioned as a lieutenant of the infantry in 1922. He joined the Wehrmacht General Staff in 1938, and in recognition of his excellent organizational skills, was appointed chief of the organization at OKH in 1942. But from 1939 onwards, as he related to his wife in letters, his Christian disapproval of Adolf Hitler's conduct of the war in Poland was intense. General von Treschow invited Stief to join the resistance in summer 1943. Due to his position at OKH, Steve was able to store and provide explosives for the various assassination attempts. On July 7, 1944, he personally saw to placing time bombs in the uniforms to be shown to Hitler in Salzburg, but Hitler left early without looking at the uniforms. That's when Stauffenberg decided to undertake the July 20th plan. Steve was arrested the evening of July 20th. After receiving the death sentence at his trial in the People's Court, he wrote to his wife, "It cannot be anything else. It is just. I erred and did wrong. It was not right to arrogantly interfere as a little human being with God's doing." Interesting motivations. I'll talk more about this on another occasion. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me here on White Resistance Radio. But I'm kind of going to kind of take a little bit of a change of pace here. One of the great singers of the 1960s and 70s of country and western, bringing the man who typified the Bakersfield sound, was a Bakersfield man named Buck Owens. He's a frequent singer on Hee Haw, a gifted comedian. This is some Buck Owens songs. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on White Resistance Radio.
Well, I love's gonna live here again. I hear feet matter. You're on the streets of Bakersfield. Hey, you don't know me, but you don't like me. Say you care less about me. And I think him as I was leaving, and I headed out.
Some songs from Buck Owens, who personify the Bakersfield sound. This is Paul Fromm, you're on the Fighting Side. I'll be back with the game tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and wine, the maple leaf forever. homes and loved ones dear firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the Maple Leaf forever. The Maple Leaf, our emblem dear, the Maple Leaf forever. God save our Queen and Heaven bless the Maple Leaf forever. Dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home. The Maple Leaf forever. The Maple Leaf, our emblem dear, the Maple Leaf forever. God save.